you didn't see that gold could be money because it didn't bear a yield. It didn't bear a yield. And I said to him, but cash doesn't give a yield either. If you put your cash in a vault, there's no yield on it. Whatever you can do with fiat currency in terms of building on top of that, the financial services ecosystem can also be applied to gold.
The most powerful people in the world, the central banks, seem not to care much about yield as they're scooping it up at a level that the world has never seen. Gold has averaged 9.9% appreciation for the past 25 years.
Yeah, there's risk there, but it's a 12% return. And for accredited investors who think that's a decent trade-off, then that can be an attractive product.
In the best of times, a 10% allocation to precious metals is vital. I don't think these are anything but normal times.
You're lending to the government. And the government is, they call it borrowing, but they have neither means nor intent to repay it. They're actually just shoveling it into the maw of the welfare state.
Does that mean the United States government is a zombie country? The United States is a zombie country at 123% debt to GDP? The whole thing is crazy. It's upside down.
I think there's only one thing the Fed cares about. I don't think they care about if you have a job. I don't think they care about if your grocery bill is up. I think they care about the solvency of the crony banks.
When you see the most well-informed traders in the world, the central banks, going on a buying spree the way that they have, that should be all people need to understand.
Nobody in India really thinks of the rupee as savings. It's just for transactions only. You get paid in rupees, you spend your rent and your food and clothing and everything else. The rest goes into gold as a matter of habit.
I think gold will be the peg to a new system.
It's always a good time to buy gold, whether there's yield on or not, because it's not just about performance, it's also about reliability. It's the one thing that can't go to zero.
Most of the really seriously wealthy have made their money by playing the game and being in the system.
In a world edging towards economic collapse and societal upheaval,
we're up against a real poly crisis.
Inflation is eating away at our savings.
A shaky banking system is putting our financial security at risk.
Government debt
is at unthinkable record highs.
And the wealth gap keeps growing thanks to an unjust monetary system.
Add in AI.
And advances in longevity disrupting jobs.
A looming property crisis.
Geopolitical tensions.
And it's clear we've got our work cut out for us.
Our podcast is here to offer some hope.
We're all about navigating these challenges by advocating for sound money principles
and smart use of tech.
Our goal is to help you take control of your financial future,
showcasing resilience, determination,
and practical solutions in these turbulent times. My name is Jason Cousins, founder and CEO of gold currency platform Glint.
And I am Andy Scheckman, CEO of gold bullion dealer Miles Franklin.
Welcome to the Resilient Compass podcast. A quick one before we get back to this episode. Just give me 30 seconds of your time. There are two things I want to say. The first one is I want to say a big thank you to the army of you who already work with us as clients and who support our mission. And for those taking the time to tune in and listen to the show today, your support is very important. And secondly, we are just getting started. And if you like what we are doing, please hit the subscribe button. And add your comments below. We need to know what matters to you. It is really important to help us grow and spread our mission. Thank you. Now back to the episode.
Hey, everybody. My name is Jason Cousins, and I'm here with my co-host, Andy Scheckman. Hey, Andy.
How are you, brother?
I'm good. How are you?
Good to see you, my man. I'm good. Thank you. World seems to be spinning faster than usual, but always looking forward to settling in and chatting with you. And I guess we have a guest who I've been very interested in learning more about his program. So I'm glad that he's here, and I'm glad to be here. So thanks for having me back.
Yeah, we're really lucky to have a great guest on today. Just stay tuned to that. I just want to start with a little story, which kind of tees up one of the reasons we've got this guest on the show, Andy. So I was at an LBMA dinner, the London Bullion Market Association dinner, in London, in the Natural History Museum. It's an amazing environment with a giant dinosaur skeleton towering over us. And at the bar, I got chatting to, let's just not name any names, but a previous leader of the LBMA. And I explained what Glint was doing in terms of enabling gold as money. And I was really surprised. I got this kind of really negative response from this guy. Oops, I've already said the sex. And he was just saying, basically, he didn't see that gold could be money because it didn't bear a yield. It didn't bear a yield. And I said to him, But cash doesn't give a yield either. If you put your cash in a vault, there's no yield on it. And in fact, you put your gold in the vault and it gives, what is it, 7% annual average return a year over time?
It's actually been 9.9% since 2000. But that's a very interesting point that you bring up and that he brings up, I must say.
Yeah, and I said to him, look, if you put a yield on gold, then of course you'd get the same thing. If you want to put your gold at risk, because there is some risk with this, but it can be managed, as we'll find out later, then of course you can get a yield on gold. In fact, my kind of attitude is that whatever you can do with fiat currency in terms of building on top of that, the financial services ecosystem can also be applied to gold. But just segueing into this then about yield, how on earth do we do that? We're very pleased to introduce you to the one and only Keith Weiner. He's an economist and he's also the founder and CEO of Monetary Metals. That is doing him an injustice because it's so much more than that. But if we had more time, we could go into a bit more detail about the wonderful Keith Weiner. But Monetary Metals, Keith, we'll talk about in a second. You're a leading authority in the area of gold, money, and credit and yield. Yeah, first of all, let's kick this off. Tell us about why anyone should be bothered about seeking a yield on gold and what the benefits are before we go into even describing what you do. I think that would be a good idea.
Two words, self-interest. Isn't it better to get paid than not? The proposition's not really that complicated or that hard to sell. What else is there to say? No, seriously, and I heard your opening remark, and Warren Buffett famously or infamously, every few years in a shareholder either letter or his address to his live audience, he feels the need to take a whack at gold as like a pinata, and he's got it up there and he's like swinging away at it. Gold doesn't pay a yield, of course, he says that many times. Gold has no utility, blah, 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 blah. And I love what he says. It falls into that category of technically that's true, but disingenuous as hell. Because of course he's defending the fiat paper dollar in its final failing throws. And doesn't really want to acknowledge the gold elephant in the room. So he's whacking away at it. Gold has always historically always had utility in a myriad of ways. And by degrees that created the Federal Reserve in 1913, tried to suppress the interest rate, set in motion a cycle. 1933, they made it illegal for Americans to possess gold. It was that white powder today. If they caught you with it, it was like prison time for possession. Re-legalized in 1975, but by that point, by 1971, they had expunged all relationship between the dollar and gold. So at that point, they regarded it as a joke. They said, let it trade side by side with frozen orange juice and pork bellies. It'll probably be, I think they said $7 an ounce was the prediction of the wise men who want to rule us all in 1975. Of course, that turned out to be just slightly wrong, as gold today is over $2,500. And they've banished it from the monetary realm, and then they sneer at it for not having a monetary role. It's like, yeah, you've got your thumb pushing down on it. Of course it doesn't do what all the things that it was supposed to do and always did, because you're not letting it. But today's a new day, and I think there is an opportunity to bring back that, you know, uncover, expose, or as we say, unlock that utility.
Yeah, I like that a lot, by the way, that you understand that the central bankers have had their thumb on the scale for a long time. Just looking at the LBMA, they admit to nearly 20 million ounces of gold traded per day, yet they say those numbers are 10 times understated. In essence, they're trading 200 million ounces of gold per day. This is a number that is just far too unbelievable to even be true, but it just goes to show the rehypothecation of gold and the idiocy of not only the gentleman sitting next to Jason, who would say gold doesn't pay any yield, neither do the dollar bills in my wallet. But by the same token, to your point, the most powerful people in the world, the central banks, seem not to care much about yield as they're scooping it up at a level that the world has never seen. So independent of yield, which obviously your product is able to offer, gold has averaged 9.9% appreciation for the past 25 years. And so it's adding a little yield on top of that is something that I'm really very interested in learning about today.
First of all, what we're talking about here for our audience, because we, you know how sophisticated you are, And there's all kinds of spectrums of people's financial knowledge. But when we talk about yield, can we just define that, Keith, a second for people?
Yeah, paying, we define it as paying a fixed return in ounces. So if the yield or interest rate is 3% and you put in 100 ounces, then at the end of the year, you have 103 ounces versus the dollar price gains of gold, which I argue is actually just simply a mirror image of the dollar falling in value. Gold is the constant, dollar is falling against it. And then they tax you on that gain, they call it the inflation gain. But if you have 103 ounces versus 100 ounces, you have a real gain. And that's what we're all about.
And can you just illustrate how that might play out? So you put gold bullion in the vault with Andy's business, or you buy some gold on Glint versus gold bullion that is creates a yield under your platform.
Yeah, so Albert Einstein's one of those quotes that everybody says, but actually turns out to be true. He said the greatest force is compounding interest. So, you know, if there's a 3% return on it and you go over 30 years, you know, what I can pull out my little calculator here, but that is quite a lot of extra gold. You'd end up with
It's over double, actually.
243 ounces over 30 years if you started with 100. So it's about compounding. And in bad years, when the gold price goes down, the yield is somewhat of a buffer against that. And then obviously when the gold price is going up, it's just an enhancer.
So we've got, so you've got the gold price going up anyway as the 9.5%. Then on top of that, you've also got your yield going up as well. Presumably that's just going to be knocking a lot of other investments out of the water when it comes to performance, is it?
It's funny you say that. We started out in launching this program in 2016 with the thought that we don't want to try to sell people who haven't decided already to buy gold on the idea that you should buy gold. We figured that we were just one more voice added to so many others. And if people hadn't decided by then, the airwaves were saturated, late night TV and infomercials and all that. We didn't think we'd be very successful in selling that. So we said, instead, let's just focus on the people who have gold. And we built a program for them to be able to physically transfer, as in FedEx, InterVault transfers, and so forth. That was the theory. The practice was that the average person thought about sending their stash, as it were, to Monetary Metals and said, you know what? I'm actually going to buy new gold to participate. And I'm going to leave my stash exactly where it is. And so their net portfolio allocation to gold approximately doubles with our clients. So they have 2 or 3% of their portfolio in gold before, and now the gold has a yield, they'll double that to 4 or 6% because it just makes sense with a yield.
So if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a question that I've been wondering for a very long time. So I send you my gold. Let's say I send you 100 ounces. Can you walk me through a typical lease or a typical bond, whereby, how does it work? What if I need the gold back? And in terms of, if I send you 100 gold eagles, am I getting back at a 3% return? Let's just say 103 gold eagles. Are you adding 3 gold eagles to that 100? These are the questions that I would have, and I'm very curious to hear your answer, actually, and excited.
All right. So we have two different programs that achieve the same proposition, which is a yield or interest on the gold. We have leasing, and then we have lending, which we parcel out as a securities offering that we call a gold bond. So in leasing, this is for businesses that have gold as physical inventory or work in progress. So I'm here in Dubai at the moment. There's a massive amount of jewelry in inventory. The jewelry sector here is selling something, I get different numbers from different people, but something on the order of 1 to 3 tons of jewelry per day is what they're selling here. I'm completely off the charts. And when you go into a jewelry store here, it's heavy, solid. I picked up a necklace, it's 89.5 grams, almost 3 ounces of gold. It's like nothing you would see in a Zales or a K jeweler in the United States. Heavy, solid stuff, and people are buying it for its gold value. And the jewelers are very competitive on what they call the making charge, how much over the spot price, and everyone knows the spot price of gold, how much over that they charge. So the average jewelry store here has something like 50 kilos of gold inventory, literally in the display cases. So that has to be financed somehow. 50 kilos is 1,600 ounces. What is that? Almost $4 million. And unless you have $4 million sitting in your pocket, that has to be financed somehow. So what we'll do is we'll purchase that inventory from them and lease it back. And so we always make sure, number one, that amount of actually greater than that, because we haircut it by about 10%, greater than that amount of metal is physically present. There are daily stock takes. There's biweekly reports signed by management assuring us that the computer is not spitting out erroneous numbers. A couple times a year, there's an outside firm going in and counting it and adding it up and weighing it and making sure that it's there. The lease is not on balance sheet, is not their asset, is not available to their creditors if they should fall over. They're obliged to have jeweler's block insurance, monetary metals as a payee. We have additional insurance at our level to try to cover it. You can never say no risk. Anybody that says I'm offering a return without risk, run, because it's not true. But we try to do everything we can to take the risk out. And this is the lowest risk thing that we can think of that generates a bona fide return, because the gold is serving a productive purpose. These businesses need a lot of gold inventory so that when the customer walks in, the store has the style the customer wants and the size the customer needs. Otherwise, the customer walks out without a transaction. And so that inventory is productive. And the whole point of monetary metals and the broader, you know, purpose, there's a why behind what we're doing, is to put gold and silver to productive use. So it isn't just sitting on a shelf, that it can actually be, you know, financing, you know, productive enterprise. So that's a lease. Lease rates net to the client vary between 2 and 5%. And for the most part, you should assume 2.5 to 3.5% would be the sweet spot of those, depending on jurisdiction, depending on a bunch of factors. The other program we have is lending. And that is principally to gold and silver mines. We have a silver bond open at the moment to a silver mine called Bunker Hill in Northern Idaho, but they're listed in the Toronto Stock Exchange. And they need to borrow to refurbish a plant and do some other site improvements. If they borrow in dollars, they have this price mismatch between what they owe, which is dollars, and the thing they produce, which is silver. They also produce zinc and lead in that particular mine. They have a price mismatch, which then creates this exposure, which they have to somehow hedge. The same thing, by the way, in the leases. If you borrow $4 million to buy $4 million worth of inventory and the price of gold drops 10%, which it could do, you're insolvent. The bank can yank the credit, force you into receivership and administration. It's a mess. So the hedging, people say just hedge with that Jedi mind trick, breezy wave of the hand. The hedging involves costs and risks and moving parts and complexities. So by financing in metal for businesses that in the gold space, this is actually not only providing capital, but actually taking the price risk away as well. So anyways, we make a gold loan, or in this case, a silver loan to a mining company. We parcel that out as a bond, sell that to investors. And the reason why it's paying 12% is it's financing something productive. This mine is getting back into production. They're going to produce a lot more metal than what they're paying in principal and interest to Monetary Metals and our bondholders. They're happy to do the transaction. And the reason why the interest rate is 12% versus 3% on a lease is you do have a credit risk. It is on balance sheet, and it's a mining company. And mining companies have a myriad of risks, that the gold is sitting in a jeweler that's under lock and key, and insurance and daily stock takes is not subject to the same risks. All of that said, this is a public mining company, and there are plenty of people that are happy to own the shares. And we always point out to our clients that, yeah, there are risks involved in the bond, but lower risks than owning the equity. Because if the company gets into trouble, the debt has to be satisfied 100% before the equity owners get anything. So we're first lien position and secured position. Yeah, there's risk there, but it's a 12% return. And for accredited investors who think that that's a decent trade-off, then that can be an attractive product.
Yeah, those souks in Dubai, they're incredible, aren't they? I mean, it's like walking into Aladdin's cave, and there's gold everywhere. And as you said, those jewelry shops are quite incredible, just filled wall to wall in gold. And of course, I was lucky enough to be in the Brinks security systems in the Dubai Multi Commodities Center just not that long ago. And looking at the security systems, actually, I think they reach out, and I think they cover a lot of the security in those shops.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
The cameras and all that stuff.
Yeah. And Dubai has quite a strict way of dealing with people who want to break the law when it comes to gold. So I don't think they have much crime over there.
It's an interesting place. If you are at a busy shopping mall and you're at a Starbucks or something like that, exposed to all the foot traffic, and you leave your laptop, your phone, your keys, your wallet, your credit cards, everything on the table and go to the toilet for 15 minutes, when you come back, that will all still be here.
Yeah.
And try that in New York or London, right?
Yeah, for sure. It's fantastic you've grabbed this bull by the horns. You've worked diligently. I met you when I first set up Glint, and you're one of our first supporters. And you told me what you were doing. And you've spent, as I said, you've spent a long time working on this, 10-year overnight success or something like that. And it's wonderful to see what you've actually built, something that really works, that you've spent a lot of time de-risking for customers. They really develop that use case and the solution to that use case. Can we just pull out, because I know you're very bright, got a lot of ideas and understanding around general investment. Where do you think the role of gold in a diversified portfolio compared to other assets like equities and bonds sits, especially in today's economic or geopolitical context? And I don't think we need to really say any more about the yield for a second on this, because whether it's gold bullion that's safe and unrisked in a vault, or whether it's got that slightly increased risk but with that massive return in monetary metals, I think probably the answer is the same, is it?
Yeah. What a funny world that equities have been in this long boom since 2009, which I think is by far the longest bull market ever. You know, for one thing, I think everybody should have a certain amount of gold in their portfolio. And if you're conservative, call it 1%. If you're aggressive, call it anything. But in our experience, our customers, you know, before they become our customers, would be 3-4%, I think would be, on the high side of average or well above average. But everybody should have some. It's a crazy world. There are crazy risks. And gold is the hedge. It's the way of avoiding all those risks. And it's not about whether the gold price is going up every day, but gold tends to be quite uncorrelated with everything else.
Actually, Ibbotson out of Chicago said it's the only inversely correlated asset to everything else these days. And I spent a lot of time in Zurich as founding my business in the early 90s. And I hadn't met a Swiss banker that would say, even in the best of times, a 10% allocation to precious metals is vital. I don't think these are anything but normal times. So yeah, I think those allocations will only grow higher as people become more aware. And certainly being able to offer a yield that is beyond competitive, I think will be very intriguing to a lot of people for sure.
History, I know, Keith, and we've been in kind of various situations throughout the decades over the last 100 years. But how do you think, is what's going on at the moment, both economically, monetary, the kind of geopolitical problems, the wars that are going on, the conflicts, are we in similar times that we've seen before? And is gold responding in the same way? Because, you know, I also am aware that, of course, gold's rising whilst interest rates are high, for instance, which is bucking the trend from what normally happens.
Yeah, normally owning gold presents an opportunity cost to the investor, right? So if Treasury is offering me 5.5% on short-dated T-bills, if I own gold, I'm foregoing the 5.5%. And so the higher the T-bill rate, the more that it causes, not necessarily me personally, but me, the generic investor, the more it gives me pause.
T-bills, just describe T-bills as well for people.
I'm sorry, short-term treasury bills.
So they're which is lending the government money, basically, isn't it?
Although nobody thinks of it that way. There's a crypto bank that is paying interest. They say they're paying interest on Bitcoin. I looked into that, and on their webpage, doesn't talk about that, but they're paying interest on dollar deposits because they're an actual regulated bank. And it says, we don't ever lend your money. We only buy T-bills. And I just started to laugh. I thought I wasn't drinking tea or coffee because I would have spit it out my nose. What do you think you're doing when you're buying the tea? You're lending to the government. And the government is, they call it borrowing, but they have neither means nor intent to repay it. They're actually just shoveling it into the maw of the welfare state. But anyway, leaving that aside, if they're paying 5.5% and gold is paying nothing, there's an opportunity cost. And when the interest rate goes to zero, whatever else one might say, the opportunity cost is gone. Yeah, so that's the, I don't know if the viewers can see this, that's a picture of the U.S. Treasury yield curve, which is quite inverted, and I think it's been inverted now longer than it ever has been in history. I may be wrong on that.
And can you explain what that means to people? Because mortals like me don't find it hard to understand things.
Yeah, if I lend my money for a month, I expect a certain interest rate of X. If I lend my money for 30 years, I should get a higher interest rate because of the liquidity risk. What if I need the money anytime between now and 30 years? So there should be an upward sloping yield curve that is further dated maturities should pay a higher rate in the normal universe. But we're not a normal universe. We have a central bank and they force us to use their irredeemable scrip as if it were money. And so all kinds of weird creatures come out of the darkness, creepy crawly things, Balrogs, who knows what, come out, and inverted yield curve is one of those things. So
looking at that chart a second. So is the market saying we're really unhappy with the risks that exist now and which we think will exist for a little while, but we think it'll work itself out in the future, within a couple of years. Is that what they're saying?
I wouldn't read it as that. I would read it as the Fed controls and the Fed pegs the overnight rate and really short dated maturities like 1 week, 1 month, even 3 months, 6 months are pretty closely tethered to that peg. But the farther out you get on the curve, the more you're running into other forces. And I see little to no demand for credit, let's say actual business credit. Like, who wants to borrow money to open another hamburger store today? Who wants to borrow money to add another printing press if you're a print shop? All the businesses that are out there, there's little to no demand for credit except on a downtick in interest rates. And we haven't had a downtick, obviously, in a long time. We've had a lot of upticks. So all of that business is quiescent in its borrowing demand. And that's one of the reasons why you see the long end of the curve trading at lower yields. The other thing that people don't think about is there are certain natural investors for long-dated bonds, and they're trying to match their assets to their liabilities. So think of pensions, life insurance, annuities. Those funds are run to try to match. They know what the average life expectancy is of the people in their annuity program or in their life insurance program, the average pensioner, and they're trying to buy long-dated assets to match the long-dated liabilities which they have. So they're a natural buyer for that stuff, but there's not a lot of supply other than the U.S. government. And so you see this inverted yield curve, which, by the way, extends. There's a further inversion in real estate and in equities, which you can think of as perpetual bonds. And so the implied yield is even lower when you look in that space. And so it's just sloping down, and the farther into the future you get, the lower the yield. And so this is the forces on why I think that the Fed is going to, whether they say or not, now they're starting to say it, they're going to be forced to lower interest rates right back to zero and beyond. It's the whole system is ratcheting downwards. And every time they try to hike rates, the last major time was 2005 to 2007. And you said, is this the same as it ever was, or is it different? Well, I think there's some key differences. Certainly the magnitude of the problem, we're 33, 34, 35 trillion. I lose track. The trillions tick by so fast nowadays that you pay attention. And if you don't pay attention for 3 weeks because you're on travel, there's another trillion. Pretty soon it's going to add up to real money.
$100,000 per second is what it works out to, basically.
$100,000 per second.
Yeah. And a trillion seconds ago was 31,688 years ago. So those numbers, not only do they add up quickly, they really add up quickly in terms of how significant they truly are. No question about it.
So anyways, we're in a place where the magnitude is growing, but the nature of the problem is the same. That the dynamic that the Fed has set up has a falling interest rate structure. And every time they try to hike, for whatever reason, either they're playing a pretense about caring about whether you have a job or not, they're playing a pretense about whether they care about whether consumer prices are going up or not, which I don't think they care about either of those. They try to hike rates, maybe just to show the world, hey, we're still in control of this thing. They try to hike rates, and then they precipitate a crisis. So on the Monetary Metals podcast, we did for October a couple of years ago, we did a whole month of what we called Zombie Month, looking at zombie corporations. And the term, to me, this is, you ever see the movie Broken Arrow? Where they come into the president's office and, sir, Broken Arrow. He says, what the hell is a Broken Arrow? It's when a nuclear warhead goes missing. The great line, it was a mediocre movie, but there's a great line where he says, I don't know what's worse, the fact that a nuclear war had gone missing, or the fact that apparently it happened so often, all have a term for it. So we have a term called Zombie Corporation, which the Bank for International Settlements, not some dank corner of the internet, the Bank for International Settlements defines a zombie as a company whose profit is less than the interest expense. And at that time, before rates were being hiked by Chairman Powell, before that, something like 20% of all corporate debt out there was zombie debt, which means it only exists by in a very permissive credit environment with very low interest rates and very tolerant investors that are willing to lend money to a company that provably can't actually even service the debt, let alone repay the principal.
Does that mean the United States government is a zombie government or a zombie country? United States is a zombie country at 123% debt to GDP? The whole thing is crazy. It's upside down.
Yeah, the U.S. is so far gone into profligacy that compare them to drunken sailors would give drunken sailors unfairly a bad name.
Yeah.
So is this the same as when companies get rated AAA or BBB? The Fitch ratings, is that the same thing? Is that where the zombie, how do you define a zombie company? How would you even find out if one is one?
You can look at its P&L and that its profit before interest is less than its interest expense. So it can't actually even pay the interest without having to borrow more.
Sounds like the U.S. government.
Right. So 20% of all the debt out there before interest rates were hiking were below this margin. Then they hike rates from essentially zero to essentially 5 or 5.5. How many more? What bigger percentage of companies are now zombie by the simple fact that you took the interest rate from here and you moved it up to there? And all the companies that had not been zombie previously at zero rates are now rendered into zombie status by the fact that you moved the interest rate so much. I have not seen an update, and it's interesting. You just flashed something that's the same report I've seen. It was dated January of 2022, which looks at data prior to, obviously, in 2021 and earlier. And it doesn't, this is all pre the interest rate hikes. If there's updated data, I haven't seen it yet. But surely a massive percentage of companies that weren't zombie at zero are now zombie at 5% plus. And all those companies are ultimately headed to default, especially in a higher interest rate environment, tighter credit, et cetera. We'll see all that where all that goes. I think the Fed is cognizant of this. I think there's only one thing the Fed cares about. I don't think they care about if you have a job. I don't think they care about if your grocery bill is up. I think they care about the solvency of the crony banks. And when they start to see defaults rising, there's a point at which they become alarmed. And then they're going to try to force rates back down. And the question is it too little, too late? Usually by the time they're noticing, there's a lot of defaults are baked in the cake. And then you can cut rates at that point, but it's too late. But on the other hand,
this is defaults by companies. You mean with their banks who have lent the money? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, every kind of debtor, from consumer credit, student loans, auto loans, home loans, small business debt, large business debt, corporate debt, bonds, across the whole gamut. And of course, foreign corporations, foreign banks, foreign governments, everybody scrambling to try to service their debts.
And this is what's so irresponsible, in my view, about the way central banks manipulate interest rates and the monetary system, is that it encourages all kinds of people to borrow money when interest rates are low. And they know fine that's not going to be what it's going to be like forever. And yet it's not exactly the thing that's rammed down people's throats. I know when you take a mortgage, they ask you to have a test to see whether or not you can still afford it when interest rates go up, everything. But we've seen banks, and unfortunately, unlike the situation with the Japanese central bank, when they pushed up interest rates and created all kinds of problems for these big firms, big financial institutions that were suddenly underwater or in trouble. If you're a normal person in the US and the Europe and the UK, anywhere in the world, and you've borrowed money, there's no way that you can influence the Japanese central bank. And again, it comes back, in my view, to the great differential between those who are closest to money supply being able to benefit more than those who are further away.
Isn't there an old joke that if you owe $100,000, then you have a problem? If you owe $100 billion, then they have a problem.
Yep.
If you owe $100 billion, what?
Then they have a problem.
Well, and if you look at the problem of raising rates is systemic. The U.S. tried to do it in 2019 and the repo market crisis ensued. They pivoted. The U.K. tried to do it not too long ago and the pensions started to blow up. They pivoted. Japan tried to do it and started to blow up the Nikkei and the Dow and other exchanges across the globe. They've since backed off. And of course, look what happened. Powell raises rates to 5% and everything starts to break. And here we go again, pivoting when we're still 50% away from their target. That is if we believe the nonsense coming out of the BLS. This is a problem that will only grow across the entire gamut from corporations and zombie corporations all the way up to zombie governments. And so this is a problem that's not going away. And it's one that people should understand more to both of your points.
Yeah, I
mean, the gold, isn't it better to own gold than a debt obligation of somebody who's so far beyond?
And I think that's the key point in this entire discussion, because when did it become normal for a country's debt, and especially one, if you look at the UK or the US, we're insolvent in every respect of the word. We are a zombie, if you use the exact same analogy, where our interest expenses are higher than our GDP or what we're taking in tax revenue. We are. And so when you talk about that, gold is an asset that has no counterparty risk. And I think that is really the key point to take away, is that it's an asset that if you can find a way to earn yield on it, and I have an asset that has a very, very diminished counterparty risk in that portfolio or in that respect, but one that broadly has none, I think that's the key takeaway. Why people should own gold and why a 3 or 4% allocation in this environment is woefully underallocated, in my humble opinion.
In my own defense, I just have to say that I was trying to be very conservative in the allocation I was recommending. And one of the things I've found in my travels, and Andy, I'm curious if you run into the same thing. I think Americans understand gold the least compared to other cultures around the world. And there's a reason, which is largely a good, healthy one in a way. America's never had a currency crisis. The worst we ever had, the inflation of the late 1970s. I was 12 years old in 1979. I remember inflation being 13% or something like that. And in the nightly news, they used to talk about the misery index, inflation plus unemployment. And you go in the rest of the world and you say, oh yeah, we had it terrible. It was 13%. They look at you and they're like, 13%? That's cute. Because they can get 13% in a month, and that's not considered hyperinflation. That's just like par for the course in a lot of countries. So Americans have never had that crisis where they had to have gold. Otherwise, the entire life savings accumulated over three generations would be wiped out in a year. America's never had that.
That's the privilege of being the world reserve currency, which one could argue is waning. And contrary to the so-called academics out there, we went 180 years being on a gold standard with zero inflation. 180 years and the greatest prosperity the world has ever seen in the way that the United States grew. And so, yeah, when you talk about how far we've come from our roots, just looking at this right here, where Roosevelt confiscated gold, it says in the Constitution that anything that isn't gold or silver or specie is treason. But yeah, we have come a long way, and the people in the United States are certainly the last to learn this very important lesson. And you can't get out of the way what you don't see coming. I worry about a lot of people who are wealthy in dollar terms, in traditional asset terms. And I think that when you see the most well-informed traders in the world, the central banks, going on a buying spree the way that they have, that should be all people need to understand. The rest is just periphery and noise to me. Tells you where this is ultimately going and how they, the most powerful entities on the planet, like the BIS, view gold.
Yeah, it's a bit confusing to me because, so we have interest rates going up, which would normally be when people would move away from gold and they would move into these bonds. Then on top of that, you've got as the gold price is going up, I'm told that ETFs have seen big net outflows. And at the same time, as it shows, if we scroll down a little bit, Ray, on this chart, you can see this chart that gold ownership amongst professional investors has risen steadily since 2018. Now, this data is from June 24. So I don't know what's happened recently, but can you make any head sense about this, guys? They're saying that 85% of professional investors are owning gold, and yet we're seeing gold outflows in the West, maybe not in the East, of course, and certainly not with central banks.
Those professional investors probably have the same allocation that Keith was mentioning of a very small amount. Even if you look at what's Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, they at times have had allocations to mining shares about this big, a tiny little bit. But the professional investor understands what's happening. Now, the professional investor are not the average financial advisors. You're talking about the guys running hedge funds, the guys that are paying attention to capital flows and paying attention to global trends. These are a whole different animal than your typical financial advisor, which I would say probably has a zero allocation to gold. But guys that are up at that level who are paying attention to the same stuff we're talking about here would be foolish not to. And I think that's what that really pays reference to.
So I can share what I've observed traveling both in Asia and in the Middle East. And that is right now, and Andy, you probably would have a better visibility into it than I do, but the bullion buying customer in the West is largely not participating in this rally from, say, 2100 to 2500, something like that. They're not. I don't think there's a huge wave of selling, but I don't think there's a lot of buying at these prices.
I would tell you that the difference is during silver squeeze, you had every Tom, Dick, and Harry wanting to capitalize on the profit. But what we what I have seen in the last run, this 21 to 25, we don't see the average investor jumping on board the way we once did, but much, much larger sophisticated investors and people who are acquiescing this responsibility, taking away the responsibility from their financial advisors and demanding an allocation. Because a lot of these people, I think a lot of people in this country feel an itch. They feel a tingle, like a charge in the air, and they can't even articulate it. They just feel something's wrong. And I think we see much larger orders, but not the volume of orders that one would expect in this environment, like we saw in January, February of 2021.
But there's four distinct worlds that are buying gold hand over fist, even as the price has gone up, and they're the ones driving it up, in my observation, which is, we'll call it Asia, but especially China, India, Turkey, and the Arab world. And for four different reasons. In China, it's distrust and fear of the Chinese government, the People's Bank of China, the yuan, and the entire, they want to get their money out of the control of China, and they want to get out of the yuan. So of course they buy dollars, but they also buy gold. In Turkey, they potentially have incipient hyperinflation. Everybody there is buying gold. I'm told the average person running around Turkey has at least 10 grams. Excuse me, the minimum that anybody would have would be 10 grams if they have any money at all. The average person would be a lot more than that. And salaries are so much lower there. That's actually remarkable. In India, they don't have incipient hyperinflation, but they just have a steady, I think the rupee goes down at a compound annual rate of something like 7% a year against the dollar. The dollar going down against gold, as you said, was it 8.9%?
9.9, yep.
9.9 since 2000. The rupee's going down against the dollar at a steady rate. Nobody in India really thinks of the rupee as savings. It's just for transactions only. You get paid in rupees, you spend your rent and your food and clothing and everything else. The rest goes into gold as a matter of habit. So Turkey, India, China, and then the Arab world is the only one that I think is an anti-dollar play. In India, it's an anti-rupee play. In Turkey, it's an anti-lira play. In China, it's an anti-yuan play. In the Arab world, the currencies are stable. They're generally, in the Gulf region, they're generally pegged to the US dollar. Those pegs, unlike the banana republics of South America, those pegs have been table flat for decades. They don't have any reason to worry that they're going to wake up on Monday morning and find that their rial or their dinar or whatever has just been devalued 40% overnight or anything like that. And they're buying gold, I think, first of all, out of cultural affinity and habit, but also out of a sense that the dollar is not good for them, and they realize it. And so they're just looking to diversify out of it. And so so there's four major worlds. These are huge in terms of population and in terms of gold appetite that are buying, while the Western, it's not just Americans, it's Canadians, it's Brits, it's Europeans, Australians. While the Western world is waiting on the sidelines, in these four worlds, they're buying. I met with somebody in the gold trade here in Dubai last week, and they said, unlike previous times when the gold price was rising, they saw diminished demand. This time around, that's not the case.
Yeah, a lot of these countries are also part of the BRICS, like the UAE, or moving in that direction, understand what gold represents as it's been revalued or reclassified as a tier one asset. And I think a lot of these countries are killing a couple of birds with one stone. And on the average investor, yes, but you look at the countries who are buying it. Turkey, as an example, just officially applied to BRICS, the first NATO member to do so. There's a lot at play here, and gold is the central theme, in my opinion, to it all. I think gold will be the peg to a new system. And all of the countries that you just mentioned, BRICS nations, understand that. And when you see a currency that is being devalued the way that ours is, the debt burden that we have, and the same throughout most of the world where countries are massively indebted, gold is beginning to, I think, be remonetized or revalued as something worth more than the currency that are used to buy it. Like you said, pay the bills, put the food on the table, pay the rent, and then put the rest into something stable, where if your numbers are correct and mine are correct, that means India has been seeing gold appreciate roughly 15 to 20% per year, compounding over the rupee over an extended period of time. This is the real reason behind it. And then going back to what we were saying earlier, who cares about the yield if you're talking about, at least in terms of gold being a non-yielding asset, when it has this type of appreciation potential? Bring in a vehicle that adds yield to it. It's something that certainly I think people should check out, because that puts it at the best performing asset on the planet. It already has outperformed traditional assets. You add yield to it, and it's something that I think is pretty tough to beat.
And I think also to a certain degree, it's always a good time to buy gold, whether there's yield on or not, because it's not just about performance. It's also about reliability. It's the one thing that can't go to zero.
Contra the, I call them court economists, the people that are just selling the Fed's propaganda that you know, believe that it could go to zero, but there is no way.
And this is a great chart here. This is the World Gold Council. I think it's quite recent data. And what I find interesting about this is that, you know, this covers both the low to medium to high bands in terms of people's, whether or not they, what's the phrase, their income. And yet you've got people, it's often thought that only the wealthy people buy gold. But you can see that in the US, for instance, 20% of all the people they did a poll on were buying gold, even at the low income bands, and 30% sure at the high income bands. But I think this is also testament to, you've seen that the kind of the retail demand in places like Costco, where people go in and buy large gold bars. You've got people now obviously being able to buy fractional gold on platforms like Glint as well. And obviously you've seen the demand, Andy, in your business as well. But I find it fascinating because a lot of the time I get people saying to me, gold's really only something for the wealthy.
There's definitely a misunderstanding or mischaracterization. I think that most of the really seriously wealthy have made their money by playing the game and being in the system. And I think they're the least likely to see that there's any flaws in it or be concerned about it in the slightest. Plus, they feel like they're betraying their whole story and their whole life's work. I think a lot of them just absolutely, if you say the word gold, they almost get angry. And it's the categories below that. It's definitely not the poor. The people that are working for $12 an hour are not buying gold in the United States. But it's the people in the middle brackets that have a little bit of disposable income, are concerned about it, don't necessarily build a portfolio of assets to lever up and then buy more assets, but they're like, okay, what do I do here? And those are the ones that turn to gold.
Guys, we've already been going nearly 50 minutes already, which is a surprise because it feels like we've only been speaking for 5 minutes, which is always a good sign. We're obviously enjoying ourselves. What? Anything else? Any final questions for Keith, Andy?
So Keith, just walk me through. A client of mine has 100 ounces of gold and wants to take advantage of your portfolio, or your program, whether it's in a Brinks vault that we would administer where we could do a internal transfer, or the client has it and wants to ship it to Monetary Metals. Where is he shipping it? And what happens if 6 months into the lease he needs to retrieve his metal? Could you just explain that? Because that's a question I get most often. And I always just say you should probably check out their website. I'm not exactly sure, but that's a question I'd like to know. And certainly I can see the need for it with a lot of people. In fact, I talked to a gentleman today who said, listen, I don't want to sell my metal. I just need it for this whatever. But it's not something I really want to do. And what do I do? So I'd love to hear just how it would work as someone who had 100 ounces of gold and wanted to take advantage of this in real time.
We have, you know, relationship with Brinks, Loomis, TDS, which is a subsidiary of AMARC, their depository system, IDS, which is a subsidiary of Dillon Gage. We have the Delaware Depository. We have a number of kind of special, unique vaults like that around the world. And so wherever the gold is, we can find an efficient place to either swap it or ship it to get it there. You raise a good point. These are contracts that have a particular maturity, and monetary metals is matching back to back. So if we're doing a 1-year lease to the jeweler, then it's a one-year lease from our clients to match that. So we're not taking the risk that we still owe. This is fractional reserve banking, right? On the one hand, you put out a 30-year loan, you take demand deposits to finance it, and then the bank gets into trouble. Well, we're not doing that. Everything is matched, which means the investor has signed a contract that says 1 year in the case of a lease. That silver bond that just flashed is actually 3-year maturity. Now, all of that said, number one, for people who have serious concerns that maybe they might need the metal, probably shouldn't put that metal into something that's a contractual obligation. If you do, and then something comes up where you need access to the metal, give us a call. We cannot, it's actually, there's a lot of perverse regulations around all this. We're not legally allowed to offer any kind of assurances that anybody can get out mid-contract. That said, people can call us, and if we can broker to find somebody else who wants to take over their position in the lease or the bond. And on those few instances where somebody's needed out in the middle, we have been able to do that.
So is the actual metal that is transferred to your account then leased out to a third party?
Typically it's swapped. So let's say in the case of the jewelry store, they already have the 50 kilos in inventory. So we're going to simultaneously liquidate the metal held in the Brinks vault and purchase and take title to the metal in the jewelry store. So it's a swap. So now that's what the client owns, is the metal or piece of that metal in the jewelry store. Not obviously not 50 kilos, but let's say 100 ounces of that. And that is that investor's metal. And then it's contractually committed for a year. As I said, if they want to get out, they can call us. And generally, because the program is growing, there's always more people that want to get in that couldn't get in or weren't there in time or whatever that can take their place. But that's a best efforts basis. We can't contractually obligate ourselves to that. We're not allowed to promise.
No, it sounds like a very straightforward, good program. The only other question I have is, let's just hypothetically say someone sent you 100 gold buffaloes, and then in 2026 or 2025, they do a year lease, the U.S. Mint stops producing gold buffaloes. Then what? So you would have to give them some other form of gold? Is it specified as to what they receive in return?
When somebody comes in, especially if they have a product like that, we are swapping them for bulk bullion because we need the fungibility. Things never work out to be an exact even 100 ounces. So we need it to be fungible. So it's a not fractional reserve, but a fractional program similar to Glint or anybody else. So at that point, if it's a product like a buffalo, there's a premium. So if they sent us 100 buffaloes, they would get more than 100 ounces of bulk pool. And then at the end, so that let's say they got 101, just to make the math easy, and then add 3% interest to that. So it's 104.0 whatever, 3 ounces. And then they say, okay, I want buffaloes back. There's a market for buffaloes. So we would trade that for buffaloes. And it probably isn't that worthwhile if somebody plans to only be in it for a year, because there's a bid offer spread on buffaloes. I don't know what that is. I'm assuming it's quite a bit wider than on eagles. Buffaloes, a special product.
And there's a bid offer. They're pretty darn close to the same price. But no, I think you've answered the question, and I think that answers a lot. And so really, someone who was sitting on 20 kilo bars of gold and really had no intention of ever doing anything with it, but passing it on to their kids, could, in essence, do a lease for 10 years or whatever. And
accumulate a lot of gold.
Yes. Now, okay, that makes good sense. That makes good sense. It's an interesting product. Congratulations. I like that idea a lot.
The bid-ask spread on kilos is a lot tighter than the bid-ask spread on coins. You know, typically, those will go in at par and come out at par. Yep. So you put in your 20 kilos, you stay in for 10 years, you come back with 20-something kilos, and those will come right back as bars. without a lot of fuss.
That's fascinating. That's a good program. And we used to do something similar to it for a very short period of time. And for whatever reason, we went a different direction. But I have a lot of people who I know would find that to be something of interest. I'm glad that I got to be on this with you today to have a better understanding of it. It's a fascinating program. I wish you nothing but the best of luck moving forward.
Thank you.
Listen, guys, we're going to wrap it up now. I just want to say thank you, Keith, for coming on our pod, our sixth episode, and may there be many more. I'm sure we'll get you come back on the show and talk about various events that are going on and as they unfold. But thank you very much for your time. It's been fascinating learning about your product. We'll put some details in the description below if you're interested in Keith's products. Of course, you've always got can come back to either Andy's business at Miles Franklin if you're interested in bars and coins. And Glint, of course, you can download the app, not only buy fractional gold, but also be able to spend it too. Look, everybody, we rely on you. We're only doing this for you. We're not doing it for us. We want to be able to share our knowledge and we do enjoy talking to each other. But please subscribe to the video so you get alerted next time we do a video. Make sure you comment below. We want this to be an interactive experience. Last week, there were some comments and Andy was able to answer some of those. So we really enjoyed listening to your questions that you've got and answering those. I'm sure if you've got any more questions, we'll also pass those on to Keith about this and we'll answer those in our next pod. It's a goodbye from me and thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Keith. Nice to meet you, brother. Hope we get to do this again soon. And Jason, as always, my man, look forward to doing this again real soon.
Thanks for having me.